We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3268. Representative Krupp, would you go ahead and come on up, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17. And Patrick, would you be so kind as to pass out the letter that I had written to the governor that was left here a couple days ago?
We'll have to go upstairs and get that.
You'll have to go upstairs and get that? Okay.
Yeah. All right. I'll be right back.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair, I have a very simple bill in front of you. Of course, every time somebody says that, we all chuckle because we know nothing in this process is simple.
That's right.
Pat, the letter that I'm referring to is a letter that I wrote to Governor Kulongoski after some time of investigating the use of our King Air aircraft with the Oregon State Police. As you know, I'm a pilot, have been... most of my life was blessed to have grown up with a father who flew, and we had an airstrip on the farm. And so it's a great passion of mine. I've been an aircraft owner for a number of years. And I began to realize over time in my going on my fifth year now in the state legislature that there's a rather inconsistent policy in regards to the use of state aircraft and specifically to the Oregon State Police. And this inconsistent policy is basically that the Oregon State Police has not been reimbursed for a lot of the properly reimbursed for a lot of the flights that they have taken for a number of reasons, because frankly there is no policy statewide in this regard. And basically that's what House Bill 3268 does. It basically just says the Department of Administrative Services shall put together policy that includes the use of state-owned aircraft. And basically it says that whenever any governmental agency uses state-owned aircraft, they need to pay for it within 30 days. That hasn't always happened in times past. And the letter that's being referenced is this letter that I've written to the governor in regards to the use of the King Air aircraft, one of which I'm happy to report we have sold on eBay. As a matter of fact, and the other one is currently there right now, I understand, is being offered up also. That is the aircraft that we have. We had two King Airs that we obtained in 1997 from the military. They were military versions of the Beechcraft 200. OSP spent a lot of money to bring those birds up to standards. Military standards are different than civil aviation standards. And over time, there has been some confusion as to about how much it costs to own one of these airplanes and operate. And frankly, we figured out that it costs, and this is what my letter will demonstrate to you, and I'm not going to go into that. You all can read it if you care to. My letter to the governor points out that using Oregon State Police's their own figures regarding their aircraft, that they were dramatically undercharging other agencies for what the aircraft was worth. They're basically charging $500 an hour for an airplane that was costing them per hour $1,265 an hour to operate.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask another question?
Sure.
You've lost me,
yes,
because I think I heard you say one of the aircraft has been sold on eBay.
That's
the other
correct.
One's up for sale now.
That's correct.
Do we have more than those two?
We do.
Oh. Okay. I was going to say, what are we going to be charging for?
Well, let me backtrack a little bit. Representative, that's a great question. The Oregon State Police operate several aircraft. They operate a Cessna 185, which is used typically for tracking of animals with ODF and W. In terms of game enforcement, they also operate a Cessna 206, which is a six-place single-engine aircraft, which is the air traffic patrol aircraft that shadows us on the highways and freeways as we're driving. They also they have another aircraft, and it's escaping me for the moment. Department of Forestry has a Cessna 414 twin-engine cabin-class pressurized aircraft. None of these airplanes are on the level of the two King Air aircraft that the OSP has. Level in terms of these are highly sophisticated aircraft They're turbine engine aircraft. They're not piston engine aircraft. They have a great deal more reliability and capability in terms of flying in bad weather. They're fully de-iced. They're aircraft that can complete the mission. However, they're very expensive to own and maintain. The other day, we had one of the aircraft up at Flightcraft, which does the maintenance for these airplanes, by the way. And the pilot side's windshield needs to be replaced with $7,000 to replace the windshield. Airplanes are money pits. I know. I've had one for many years. It's a little old, beat-up Cessna 150 single-engine two-place airplane, and they're still money pits, any way you look at it. My point is that we've been sacrificing road troopers for flying folks around this state because this airplane has been operated at a loss. The whole point of my policy is to say, and the policy I'd like to have us put in place by statute, is that we're not going to fly these airplanes at a loss anymore. If we're going to fly them, let's reimburse the agency for their actual costs. If you go to, if you call up Flightcraft like I did the other day, they currently don't have a King Air 200 on leaseback. They have a smaller version of the King Air on leaseback. If they did have a King Air 200 on leaseback, they would charge $1,250 an hour for it. It's costing us about $1,262 an hour for what OSP has spent on the airplane. OSP has gotten some rental air income back off of the airplane to offset some of that expense. It's only been $300,000 out of the $1.3 million that they've spent on the airplane.
Representative Krupp?
Yes, Representative.
Sorry, I'm...
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, sir. The price is varying, I'm assuming, based on... The King Air is a Learjet, is that correct?
It is not, sir.
Oh, it is not.
It is not a... It's a turboprop aircraft.
Turboprop.
A Learjet is a pure turbine.
Now, does the price vary is question one. And question two, is the rental capability open to the public or just state agencies?
Currently... The gentleman's agreement that exists between state agencies is only certain state agencies can rent state aircraft from each other. Not all can. For instance, we in the legislative branch cannot hire any of the state-owned aircraft. If we wanted, we can hire a van from the state motor pool and go hold a committee meeting in Burns or Ontario or Klamath Falls and take 2 days to get there. But the legislative body cannot hire one of the state aircraft, fly out there in the same day, hold a meeting, come back.
Follow up. Is it that we can't hire it or that we can't afford it?
It is both, actually, right now, clearly. We actually did some numbers. We had a small study group that looked at this in the last interim. We looked at some numbers of what it would cost to send a committee overnight with per diem, hotels, rental of a van to go out across Oregon. And it was at least, and not for the King Air aircraft, but for the forestry aircraft, which is a little less expensive. It was about a wash.
Wow. Thank you.
But the time productivity was obviously considerably different. So the point I'm just trying to make to you, colleagues and Mr. Chair, is that whoever is using state aircraft in terms of internal agencies need to reimburse those agencies for the full real cost of flying those aircraft, of owning them and maintaining them. And we need to do that within 30 days, especially in these tight budgetary times. Now, I will tell you that everyone who's flying state aircraft have really cut back on those flights. And in fact, two of the pilots that fly the King Airs are walking around the building here as security for us right now because they're not flying. These are tough economic times, and when times get a little bit better, and it makes sense to fly some of these aircraft, again, I think that's perfectly appropriate. All I'm saying is that we need to have a formal policy from the Department of Administrative Services on the use of state-owned aircraft that reimburses the agencies properly and in a timely manner. And that's really what this this bill is all about. And Mr. Chair, I'll take any other questions.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Krupp?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
I'm going to recess the public hearing on House Bill 3268. I'm going to open a Public hearing on House Bill, on House Joint Resolution 19. I'm going to ask Gina, go ahead and get the list if you would, and if you would go ahead and let us know. HJR 19 is on the.
We don't have a sign-up sheet.
Okay, this is. I'll tell you what, this is. Members, I put this on the public hearing only list, and we've got a bunch of mayors in the room, and I'm going to give them courtesy so that they can get on with their other business that they have. So, Ken, why don't you just go ahead and come up and bring up the mayors that you want to, and bring them up in 3 and 2, and that would be HJR 32, isn't it? It's not 19.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Well, okay, I'll close the public hearing on HJR 19. That one's done. I'll open a public hearing on HJR 32. That was supposed to be a tap
anyway. So.
Okay. 32, sorry. Now we can bring up the sign-up list on 32. Thank you. That's all right. Nobody knows what the chair is doing, including the chair.
Gina's earning her money today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I was confused with the numbers here, but thank you for clarifying that. For the record, my name is Ken Strobeck. I'm the executive director of the League of Oregon Cities. Joining me here at the table today are Joanne Sutherland, city manager from the city of Redmond, Helen Berg, mayor of Corvallis, and John McArdle, the mayor of Independence. Also in the audience, we have a number of other mayors and city councilors from Klamath Falls, Medford, Enterprise, Dallas, and other communities that I've that are members of our board of directors, having a board meeting later today. We're here to talk about HJR 32, and I'll just briefly introduce the concept and then ask the city officials to add their personal reflections and examples. What this bill is not a radical change or anything. It simply is an effort to institutionalize a principle that most people believe already exists in the state of Oregon. Since we all serve the same constituents, we're all elected by the same people, this is just simply a matter of recognition of the relationship between state government and city government. We provide different functions. The state doesn't want to get into the business of running local water and sewer systems. Cities are not in the business of running state penitentiaries. But there are many, many places where we do cooperate and where we do have a very close working relationship. Also, one level of government is not better than another level of government, and simply because the legislature has the power to take away local authority, that doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. We've seen many examples of people who have a problem at a local level who, instead of solving it locally, come to the legislature and say, would you please pass a law that stops everyone from doing that, make a one-size-fits-all policy. And I think especially those of you who have experience in local government know that one size does not fit all. What works on the coast doesn't work in eastern Oregon. What works in southern Oregon doesn't work in one of the large cities in the Portland metro area. It's important to acknowledge that this bill takes away no one's authority. It simply establishes a process for carefully evaluating when and if a legislative preemption of city authority is appropriate. It sets a little higher standard. It says that the legislature needs to come up with 2/3 vote in each chamber and an explicit statement on a bill that this is a bill that preempts city authority. And that's all it does. It refers this question to the people, to ask the people of the state if they're interested in having this kind of a change, to recognize what we believe is an already existing positive relationship between the state government and city government. As we saw in 1996, the people overwhelmingly supported ballot measure 30, the unfunded mandates bill, and we believe that they would have a similar positive response to a bill that simply recognizes that cities and the state need to work together cooperatively and to be more careful about how we go about exercising authority. My final point is this is an analogy to that's very similar to the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. You know, states hate the idea of the federal government coming in and saying you have to do something or you have to make a law regarding this or you have to comply with federal rules. And the 10th Amendment says that whatever powers are not specifically given to the federal government reside with the state. And in many ways, there's a similar provision in the Oregon Constitution that says cities that have home rule authority should be able to govern the activities within their city boundaries. And this is an effort to try to recognize that, ask the people their opinion. So I'll turn it over to City Manager Sutherland.
Good morning, Chair Kremel and members of the committee. As he indicated, I am the city manager of the city of Redmond, Oregon, right in the middle of your state. I've had the opportunity to serve in this position for about 20 years in several cities across Oregon. And so I've had the opportunity to work with local constituents as well as many city council members. And charter authority of municipalities was established to give cities the ability to make local decisions and to fit their individual communities' needs. City councils are elected to represent the local citizens, and they live and work where their constituents can contact them face-to-face on a daily basis. I know I meet a lot of those people in the Safeway checkout line and hear just exactly what they're thinking about local issues. Our council meetings, almost all statewide, are televised for viewing. We have good media coverage and detail, and citizens are interested and are becoming more knowledgeable all the time about local issues. Local government authority under our charter should not be eroded or challenged without having this opportunity for the vote of the people. Preemption of our local authority really weakens the democratic process. Cities work to be a partner with their state government, as we all serve the same constituents that you have. I represent also an organization in Central Oregon made up of six or seven small cities, and they've taken the position in support of this resolution. And our support is based on any preemption of a municipality's ability to initiate any ordinances or to establish revenues that may be needed on the local local level, and that would be in contrast to the intent of our state's constitution related to local control. I think municipalities throughout Oregon need to have a vehicle to address costs of services, and we need to be able to do that locally. I urge you to pass H.R.J. 32, and this would provide the protection to our constituents' right to the local self-determination and allowing our local citizens to make decisions regarding their own cities. Oregon's founders recognize the city's independent authority, and so should we, and I would hope that you would support us in that. And we would like to ensure that we work at the local level to make the best decisions for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, members of the committee. I'm John McCardle. I'm the mayor of Independence. I'm also the vice chair of the Oregon Mayors Association, some 150 mayors from around the state. Briefly, I want to make a couple of comments. Cities, of course, are strong partners with other cities in their region. We work with counties, state and federal government, because we have to work together to get things done. It doesn't happen otherwise, and for those of us in local government, our constituents who stop us in the grocery store or while I was cutting the lawn last night, people came up and were talking to me about issues that we needed to work together with our sister cities and counties. People expect that level of working together. Some of the hasty preemptions that have come up in this legislative session, and I'm sure will happen in the future, are really weakening our ability to provide services. To put a real face on it, you know, there was a telecommunication bill that came up that, if passed, is going to hurt my city, and it's going to hurt a bunch of other cities in this state. And it's going to prohibit us from doing things that are necessary for our economic development in our community, when the private utility provider wasn't going to provide that service that we needed till 2014. And then we pressed them. They said they'd move it up to 2013. And so exactly. What more do I need to say? We also shouldn't play politics with our local hometowns. Sometimes groups are coming to the legislature and asking for a quick fix. They don't want to come and take care of the issue in 238 different cities in our state, because each of our cities are different. And they don't want to take the time. They want to come and try to spend a lot of time in front of you folks and try to get a one-size-all fit and fix. Well, each of our cities is different. My city is different from Dallas. It's different from Redmond. It's different from Portland. All of us have different individual needs, and I like to think that we know how best to run our communities. The people in our communities know what is necessary. And if they don't like something the city's doing, let me tell you, remember I told you about cutting the lawn and people coming up? Folks will do that in the grocery store. There's no reason I would spend 45 minutes in the produce section otherwise. So there's definitely really clear. So if change needs to happen, this bill allows for, in a deliberative process, for you folks with a supermajority to make a change if it is determined to be good public policy. So I ask for your positive vote on HJR 32 and move that forward so that the voters of this state can formalize the relationship between state and cities. Turn it over to Helen.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Cromwell and members of the committee, my name is Helen Berg. I'm the mayor of the city of Corvallis and treasurer of the League of Oregon Cities. It has been my experience, and I expect yours, that blanket policies are more often than not bad policies. And as we all know from experience with federal laws, universal remedies in the form of blanket policies tend not to work on the ground with individual communities, individual constituencies. Our constituents deserve a better, more tailored government than that sort of thing provides. Now, Oregon's founders recognized that cities' independent authority, and we have a legacy to uphold and a responsibility to continue those founding principles. Oregon's city's authorities come from the Constitution, and that authority is not reliant upon any additional grant of authority from the state. Preserving this authority allows for those of us in local government to provide innovative and, in these days, perhaps most important of all, cost-effective policymaking at all levels of government. It is a strong Oregon tradition. And let us elevate this matter of the state and local government roles to a statewide vote by your and our constituents. And it is in that Oregon tradition that we ask you to support HJR 32.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Mabry?
Mayor, I think you answered the crux of my question, but I'd like to enlarge on it. You said the authority for providing city services comes from the Constitution. Based upon that premise, which is absolutely true, this should be redundant to offer such a bill, because we in this body should be actually acting very, very carefully when we pass a statute that limits your ability to govern yourself because it's been granted constitutionally. Is that not correct?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Mabry, let me say I couldn't possibly have expressed it better. And it is because of that that we feel so strongly that a two-thirds majority will necessitate the kind of careful consideration and deliberation to be absolutely sure that this is something that would be important not to allow the cities to do.
Thank you. Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, I think this is more for you. I understand this is only set for a public hearing today, so we won't be going to work session. Coming from what many people refer to as the Republic of Eugene, I understand, I think, the need of allowing for local control, since it seems like we have, in fact, you and I have been on the floor together fighting battles where, let's say, the greater body may not agree with what an individual city has done. But I am somewhat concerned with the threshold of the two-thirds, which would require 40 members in the House and, I guess, 20 and the Senate, and I'm wondering if you would consider three-fifths, which would give us a higher threshold than the simple majority, but still put it within, I think, what I would consider a more manageable level to be able to conduct the business of the state when it is, in fact, all the criteria is met as required by this resolution.
Mr. Chair, Representative Przanski, I don't think there's any magic in the two-thirds percentage versus three-fifths. The concept, again, is, as Mayor Berg just expressed, to make sure that any preemption that comes up is clearly identified as such, that has the attention of the legislature to the extent that it requires a larger than simple majority. So three-fifths, two-thirds is probably an acceptable amendment to the bill. Again, this would be something that that the people of Oregon would have to vote on as a constitutional amendment, since it does address that section of the Constitution that deals with city authority. And I would think that assuming the people approve such a measure, that would be even another reason that the legislature would want to be more careful about passing any preemption law if they got that direct feedback from the voters that this is an issue that they feel strongly about.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I agree with you, but we've also seen what this body has done when the voters have actually passed initiatives and actually have basically tried to refer stuff back, and the voters seem to speak very loudly, even though it may be a close vote the first time. The second time, it's usually resounding. You heard what we said, and we meant it.
Right, exactly.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me have Senator Bill Morissette and Representative Joanne Verger come on up. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I am Oregon State Representative Joanne Verger from District 9. I'm going to be very brief, and I'm sorry that I have to be so brief, but I left another responsibility because I wanted to be here to talk about the seriousness of this issue. I believe that in this session, I have seen more preemptions than I have seen during my 10 years in local government and in the time that I have served in this body, which was the six sessions that I've been in. If we were to continue to try to preempt local government, what we are really saying to the local people in our communities that elected all of us is that you're not that important. You don't know, even if you vote, you don't really know how to run your city. Because when you preempt, you're saying to the voters or to the local government, don't go to your voters because you're preempted. How I wish that the federal government could be as considerate as this bill when they send unfunded mandates down to the state of Oregon. I believe that this is a fair request that when you preempt government, you must have a majority of the people in this body that will say you are right. This is a preemption we absolutely must have, and we will not usurp the authority of the local people in our cities and counties that elected us to come here to represent them. And I am pleading with you to seriously consider this bill. And I thank you very much, and I apologize for having to leave on such short notice.
Thank you, Representative. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I'm Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. I should say Mr. Chair and former President of the Oregon Mayors Association. I'm really going to put you on the spot. I do appreciate having this opportunity to appear before you and the fact that you're hearing a bill that is near and dear to, I think, the hearts of many people who served in local government. I served as Mayor of Springfield for 10 years. I continue to be involved in the city. For instance, right now, the city passed a local gas tax, which is being challenged with an initiative drive in Springfield. The city council made that decision. The voters may choose to make their decision on that, which is the way it should be. It bothers me that we are not only preempting cities from getting revenue that they need, but we're cutting revenue that we normally send to them, like cigarette tax and other things. We're taking money away from cities and counties, and yet we expect them to continue to perform the vital services, the court systems, the drug alcohol treatment, the mental health treatment. All of that takes place at the local level, and the state is not providing funds. And at the same time, we're taking the ability of the cities and counties to do that. So I think this is a very important bill, and I do applaud you for having the hearing, and I hope that we can move this on. Thank you very much.
Senator, thank you. Are there any questions for the Senator?
Yes.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Morissette, can you give me, in your opinion, do you see that this bill promotes government partnership, and how?
Well, it's interesting because sometimes there's a disconnect between legislators and who their constituents are, and in the sense that they represent the same constituents as local government represents. And I think that it does provide a partnership. It emphasizes that, and it gives greater emphasis to the needs of local government, and it does force in many ways the legislature to look at that and to be in touch with their community. I know that there have been representatives of local government who have come to the legislature and denied in some ways that they represent the same constituents, and I think that's unfortunate.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Senator. Appreciate you. With that, I'm going to. Is there anyone else that wanted to speak on House Bill or, excuse me, H.R. 32? Seeing none. Before I close the hearing, I'd like, if you're a mayor. Or if you're here for the League of Oregon Cities board meeting, I'd like you to please stand up. I'd like to say thank you for being here. Appreciate your attendance and your interest in this matter. I'm going to close the public hearing on HJR 32. Thank you. Okay, we're going to go to kind of a simultaneous hearing here. I don't have a number in here. Okay. We're going to go to kind of a simultaneous hearing here. House Bill 3109, 3110, and HJR 34. I'm going to open a public hearing on those issues. You want to give us a rundown on those while Gina gets the list? And then, Commissioner, are you here for this group?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair. These bills, House Bill 3109 and 3110, do similar things with a different county office. 3109 authorizes the governing body of a county, subject to the approval of the majority of that county's electors, to make the office of county treasurer an appointed office rather than elected office. House Bill 3110 makes the position of county assessor an appointed rather than elected office. In the case of House Bill 3109, the treasurer's office, because it is also mentioned in the Constitution as an elected office, House Joint Resolution 34 proposes an amendment to the Constitution which would amend the Constitution to allow the office of county treasurer to be an elected office.
Okay. What I would like you to do as you're speaking, if you are referencing either bill, then just let us know that. But you can feel free to kind of encompass your comments. We've got the record open on all three issues. They're so closely related that I wanted to do that. Representative Mabry?
Mr. Chair, if I could, I introduced all three of these measures at the request of Deschutes County, but I want to let the panel know that it wasn't just a courtesy. It's something I think makes a lot of sense. The bills are permissive, not mandatory. We're not mandating that anyone do anything. But what really makes sense to me is, let's take just simply the position of assessor. There are certain qualifications to be a county assessor that, for example, I couldn't qualify for. So if I wanted to run for county assessor in my county, I'm not qualified to do that, and I could be elected, but I couldn't ever take office. There are lots of small counties that don't have anyone living in their county that meets that qualification, and yet it's an elected position. The requirement is that that position to be elected, they must live in the county for a year before they can run for election. So you would be in a position of asking someone to move from, pick a county, Lane County to Wheeler County, and live there for a year without a job, so that they could run for that elected position, which may in fact only be a half-time position in some of those small counties anyway. So it's something that really makes sense, but I want to stress that this is permissive. It allows the local electorate to decide whether they want to do this or not. It is not something that's mandatory. So,
thank you, and I apologize, Representative, for not asking if you wanted to testify on the bill and go around to the testimony table, but you just accomplished that, so thank you. Commissioner?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dennis Luke. I'm a Deschutes County Commissioner. I'm going to testify on all three bills at the same time, if that's okay, and in interest of time, they do pretty much the same thing. House Bill 3109 is a permissive language bill that allows citizens in non-charter counties to decide whether they would like their treasurer and their assessor to be elected or appointed. It doesn't mandate anything, as Riz previously pointed out. And Oregon counties come in a lot of shapes and sizes. Some are our county commissions, as we are in Deschutes County. Representative Mayberry came from a county judge county where they have a senior elected judge with usually two other commissioners. Some counties are charter counties. Some counties have full-time county administrators. Some don't. So there's quite a few different sizes and shapes, depending a lot of times on the complexity of the county government and the size of the county government. The argument could be made, and I'm sure will be, that Deschutes County or any other county who wants to do this could be a charter county. There have been two votes since I've lived in Deschutes County since 1973 on charters. Both have been turned down for various reasons. And there are drawbacks to being a charter county. Some charter counties simply do not fit in some types of organizations. And maybe the reason that only 9 of the 36 counties are charter counties. And what is a charter county anyway but the legislature allowing the voters of a county to choose their own form of government? And I think that's all this bill is letting the voters in our county or any other county that so chooses to decide what type of shape of government should be in. And Representative Mayberry made some excellent points. Scott Langton, who will be saying a couple words, is the Deschutes County Assessor. And Scott was the elected assessor of Molalla County when we were looking for the number two person in our assessor's office. He applied, was hired, and then when our current assessor retired, Scott was appointed. And then successfully ran for the position. But if Scott hadn't been there a year, we couldn't have appointed him to the assessor position because of the requirements. There are counties. I talked to the commissioners in Union County, and there are some real when their current people retire, they have some real problems on finding people, one, who are qualified to run. And once you find a qualified person, convincing them to run. Because to run, to give up your business and run for elective office isn't always the best family decision people can make. So this bill, is strictly permissive. We are not wanting to tell any other county how they should set themselves up. That strictly is up to them. But I believe those who oppose the bill are telling us how we need to be formed as a county government, and we're just asking for the same rights that those who choose to form charter governments have, because those who choose to form a charter form of government have this privilege, but because we choose not to go through that process, we don't. And so I urge the committee to pass the bill and move it to the floor of the do pass recommendation. We thank you for your time and consideration. With me today is Marty Wynn, Deschutes County Treasurer, and Scott Langton, Deschutes County Assessor.
Thank you, Commissioner. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Marty Wynn. As Mr. Luke just mentioned, I'm the Finance Director and Treasurer with Deschutes County. I'd like to just mention a little bit about my background, because I think it relates to our circumstances in Deschutes County. I was appointed as the Finance Director in January 1996. In September of 1996, I was appointed to the elected office of treasurer when the elected treasurer at that time decided to retire.
I then was elected beginning January 1998 to a four-year term, and then last November re-elected for a four-year term beginning January 2003. I'm not here representing the organization, but I am also the president-elect currently of the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers. Also, my background includes that of being a city finance director of the city of Gresham and another city in California. I'm here this morning in support of House Bill 3109. I think these proposed changes make a lot of sense for the reasons mentioned earlier. I'd like to just briefly touch on the why it makes sense from a technical point of view. If the county's treasurer responsibilities also include the finance and accounting functions. The main point that I would like to make is that, in my opinion, not only is it not necessary to have a separate elected person responsible for cash management, treasury management, but because the function directly integrates with the finance and accounting functions, it is more efficient and cost-effective to have the function under the responsibility of one chief financial officer, one financial manager. There are a number of such arrangements, such home rule charters and others in the state, and I think they've proven to be very successful. In support of this opinion, I think it's important to know, and as you probably know, cities and school districts don't have a separate official responsible for treasury function. Treasury cash management functions in school districts are very similar to county government. Investments are investments. Cash management is cash management in most respects. Banking relationships are the same. Cities and schools are audited similar to counties. They have internal controls and state statutes in place for the important requirements to have essential checks and balances. In closing, I'd just like to mention that when I applied for the appointed position of finance director, I was among 70 applicants from Oregon and other states. And I think it would be a much more advantageous situation for our county when I leave and they advertise for this position that it not be advertised with the requirement that that person also run for elected office every 4 years. Thank you for the opportunity to express my point of view.
Go ahead.
I'm Scott Langton. I'm the Deschutes County Assessor. I oversee and manage a department of 34 employees and just short of a $3 million budget. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3110. The reasons that I support this bill I've thought long and hard over for quite some time, both as the elected assessor in Deschutes County and also the former elected assessor in Wallowa County. During my successful campaigns in both counties, I always had the issue that, unlike other elected officials, I virtually had no platform to run on. Personally, I think an elected official should be a policy setter, and I see the role as an assessor as a policy implementer. Since the passages of ballot measures 5 and 50, the job of the assessor has become much more complex and detailed. An assessor has to be much more than just a property appraiser. They have to be a professional manager, and they also have to have a good understanding and background of the complex Oregon property tax system. I view this job similar to that of like a county planner or other such professional managers. Currently, in those counties that elect their assessors every 4 years, there's a potential for change in leadership. With all the complexities of our current system, I see this could lead to instability. And on the flip side of that, if an assessor is not doing a job, why should the county have to wait 4 years to address the problem? In my last race, which was contested, I didn't get the feeling that there was much interest among the constituents. The newspapers, though all endorsing me, all questioned why this was elected position. In my race, I came in first. Mr. Undervoat came in a close second, and my opponent, a longtime resident and also an owner of a private fee appraisal business, came in third, which didn't show me there was a lot of interest among the voters. And also in last November's election, the citizens of Deschutes County overwhelmingly decided to appoint rather than elect the county surveyor. For these reasons, I support this bill, and for these reasons, I feel this is an appropriate question to ask at this time of the citizens of Deschutes County. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Mr. Chair, one thing I forgot to mention, there are technical qualifications for the assessor's office, but there are none for the position of treasurer.
Colleagues, any questions for this panel?
Just one for clarification. Both of these positions are nonpartisan as well. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Any other questions? Any other thoughts? And if not, then I'm not sure if anyone else is up.
Yeah, we can. We're okay. Thank you.
No questions?
We're done.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let me have Sherry Anderson, Michael Long, and Ernestine Kilgore. Come on up, please.
Chairman Krummel and members of the committee, my name is Sherry Anderson, and I'm honored to be the elected treasurer of Clackamas County in Oregon. I live in Oregon City. I would like to present the following testimony in opposition of House Bill 3109. I would also like to point out that fellow appointed treasurers from the home rule counties of Multnomah and Washington County both joined me in opposition of this House bill. Firstly, I have been asked to speak on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Treasurers and Finance Officers, of which Marty Wynn has said he is the president-elect of. On Tuesday, March 18th, the members of the aforementioned association voted overwhelmingly to oppose House Bill 3109 with a vote of 22 in opposition, 5 in support, and 2 neutral. I would further like to read the following testimony that was addressed to Karen Schell, our current president of the Oregon Association of County Treasurers, from the Oregon Association of County Clerks. Dear Ms. Schell, the majority of the Oregon Association of County Clerks would like your members to know that they support your association in opposing House Bill 3109. Our members have been encouraged to contact their legislators about this proposed bill, and we wish you well in defeating it. I would now like to make a comment on my own behalf, speaking as Sherry Anderson and not for the association. I and many of my county treasurer colleagues oppose House Bill 3109 for the following reason. Using Representative Mabry's term, this bill is redundant. As we have, well, we haven't heard yet, but we will hear that there is in further testimony that home rule charter election provides a much more comprehensive option for voters. Under the Constitution, it requires that the county charter determine the organization of the county, its officers, their number, their election or appointment, qualifications, tenure, compensation, powers, and duties. Those are all set out in the Constitution, that is what a home rule charter must do. House Bill 3109 is a woeful substitute for a well-conceived and thoughtful home rule charter. In addition, and this goes back to some earlier testimony from the cities as far as the Constitution, I must remind members of the committee that the treasurer is a constitutional position. We are defined as elective under the Constitution. Because we are elected and in the Constitution, it provides us independence from the Board of Commissioners and the County Administrator. We are responsible and accountable to the citizens of our county. The Home Rule Charter option, in essence, the County Treasurer ceases to exist. There is no constitutional County Treasurer under a Home Rule Charter. That position, because you either have a constitutional or a Home Rule if you have a home rule, you do not have a constitutional treasurer. The home rule charter defines what the treasurer or treasury professional will do in that county. We have 9 home rule charters in the state of Oregon, 8 of which appoint their treasurers, 1 of which Josephine County elects their treasurer, still determined to elect their treasurer.
Mr. Chair? Yes, Representative Avakian.
Could you talk just a little bit more about why, as an elected official, being independent right. from the rest of the state government is important, and how changing this to an appointed position would hurt or help that?
Right. I can only speak for my experience in Clackamas County, which has been a very positive experience. My office manages the portfolio of Clackamas County, which is $200 million. I am the signer on all of the county checks, and I must approve, pursuant to the board asking me to, the payment of county funds out. I have a number of other duties that are assigned by statute, such as trust maintenance of trust accounts, which we do for various types. There's all sorts of things in the statute that say when we must open a trust account. And these two treasurers, who have much longer history being county treasurers, can probably address more of those questions. But, in fact, would you like them to say? Can I open up and have them speak, or would you like me to finish?
They can maybe when they speak.
Yeah, when they're ready to speak,
okay.
You can go ahead and...
Sure. So the Oregon Revised Statute set out the duties of the treasurer, and then there are other duties that may be assigned to the treasurer. And the core of the duties of the treasurers go back to the independence of the treasurer and how the treasurer is a watchdog over, and that was the purpose of the treasurer, to be the watchdog over how money is spent. It doesn't necessarily happen that way. I mean, we're a team in Clackamas County, and I certainly don't exercise my, the prerogative, I suppose, but it does exist. And as an independently elected official, I make decisions that may be in conflict with those of my board. The potential is there. I try not to have that happen, but it could happen because of the duties of the treasurer. So...
Thank you.
And perhaps they can answer further. In a home rule, because there's a shift of that accountability, the treasurer is defined by the board. The treasurer is accountable to the board. The board hires them, sets their salary and all those things, and assigns specific duties. There is no public accountability. House Bill 3109 does not remove the treasurer from the Constitution. The treasurer is still a constitutional office, still must take an oath of office as being an appointed treasurer. I, as well as many of my colleagues, find that a conflict of interest in that we are taking an oath to uphold the Constitution, taking an oath to uphold the values of our county and the constituents in those counties, but yet we are appointed and hired by the county administration and therefore have no true independence from them in those instances where we may have a conflict. That is pretty much my testimony. Okay. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm happy to... I'll stay here. So.
Okay. We'll ask questions after the panel is finished. Go ahead.
Chair Crumble and members of the committee, my name is Ernestine Kilgore, and I am elected as the county treasurer of Wallowa County. And I am opposed to House Bill 3109, authorizing the treasurer's position to be appointed rather than elected. And I also oppose, for the same reasons, H.J.R. 34. The supporters of this bill are saying that this is necessary because we in rural areas cannot get qualified people to run for this position. Coming from a rural area with a population of about 7,100 people, I take offense to these statements. I am on my 4th term as an elected treasurer in my county, and when I took and ran for my position, I felt I was very qualified, and I feel that I am still qualified to do the duties that are put upon me. House Bill 3109 states that the appointed treasurer still has to be a resident of the county 1 year prior to their appointment. In essence, it does not change the pool of candidates. You are only taking the choice away from the people and giving it to the commissioners. there already is, in my feeling, a procedure to allow counties that wish to do this to not have this position elected, but have it appointed, and that is under home rule. There also has been statements made that, well, we can't, if you get someone, they're not qualified, they don't do the job, there's no way to get rid of them. Well, that's not true. We don't like to take and use that technique, but there is statutes that do cover how you could remove any elected official that does not perform their duties of their job. In maybe a little bit more elaboration with your questions you were asking, Sherry, I think that any time you take power away from an elected office and give it under the jurisdiction of just a board, you lose some of that independence. Like Sherry said, there are times when conflicts could come up. There's issues that, as an independent elected official, I feel that I have a right to stand up and say, as an appointed person, you're under their jurisdiction. I'm not sure you would always feel that comfortable in being able to state how you feel about a certain issue, or say that something comes up that you may not really agree with your board. I thank you for letting me testify today. This is my first time, and it's interesting.
Thank you for being here, Mr. Long.
Thank you, Chairman Kimball and representatives. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm the elected treasurer in Klamath County, and I'm also appointed to four additional positions in the county. I'm not going to repeat the stuff that's just been said to you. What I want to let you know is I'm in full support of what they've said here, and also I come with the full support of all of our elected officials of Klamath County, the Board of County Commissioners. They feel very strongly we have a very good team of elected officials, and they feel the independence of having us all work there, become a team to give them different insight without having the worry about if we're in an appointed position and not only saying what they want to hear. They like to have that independence, and also having us elected by the members of our county to represent them. So they're full support of in opposition of this, of these bills. They don't feel it's necessary. They feel strongly that the home charter is available there. Klamath County has voted down the home charter, where they were going to make everybody appointed except for the sheriff, the DA, and the Board of County Commissioners. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Kipps?
My question is, the assessor and treasurer positions, are they the same statewide as far as a pay schedule? Are they paid? Are they full-time? Is it?
The elected offices in the counties, their pay schedule is determined by what is called the compensation board, which is set out in statute. So those positions currently, I think in all counties, are going through that compensation board process. They compare the salary of the treasurer in Clackamas County to comparable positions in Multnomah County, or in, they use Multnomah County and Marion County and the city of Portland for my comparables. They compare our salaries, and then the compensation board makes a recommendation to the board of, to the budget committee at the time when the budget is being approved as to what they should do with those salaries. And that brings up an interesting point, because under this amendment, House Bill 3109, the appointed treasurer and appointed assessor would still be subject to the compensation board. So you would not be allowed to negotiate your salary as an appointed person with your board or your county administrator. That you would be negotiating your contract with the budget committee during the budget process.
Follow up,
Representative Kitts.
So, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're negotiating your salary. It's not predetermined at the point of
as an elected office. It is Chair Krummel and Representative Kitts. It is as an elective office. My salary is set through the compensation board. Appointed offices are available to negotiate their salary as any person in the county would, the finance director or those positions. But under House Bill 3109, they specifically keep the appointed treasurer and appointed assessor subject to the compensation board.
And the other part of my question was, is it full-time?
Yes. And yes, and they're all paid.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Representative Mabry?
I would first like to express my undying gratitude and support and admiration for you, those of you that serve. I hope you don't think this is an affront. I worked many years with the good treasurer from Klamath Falls in the Association of Oregon Counties, and I couldn't have greater respect for the job you do, so I hope you don't feel that way. Part of the reason why I supported this bill, these bills, was because in my own county, Wasco County, I shouldn't speak for them officially, but I think my county treasurer would just as soon remain elected as you would, but I also believe that my county assessor would just as soon have that be appointed. And none of these bills make either one of those positions mandatory. They just make them permissive. By not doing this, it will require that, for, like in Wasco County, the assessor remain elective, contrary. The testimony that I've heard you say is that you want to retain that. My question is, shouldn't the local electorate be able to determine that? In other words, if you in Clackamas County were to decide that, yes, it would be a good idea to have this done, you would have to take a measure to your local electorate to approve that before that could happen. Is that not worthy of your consideration?
Chair Crummell and Representative Mabry, these bills... The Home Rule Charter, the essence of a Home Rule Charter is that a county determines what they want to be, what they want to look like, whether they have an elected assessor, appointed assessor. It is the whole government taken as a whole and has design and thought given to it as it is taken to the voters. The voters know the roles and responsibilities of each of those positions when they go to vote on those positions. They're making a purposeful decision to vote for a new form of county government. If we take each individual piece and take them out, there is no, the public has no context in which to view the entire county government any longer. You're playing with the constitutional county in a way that really should be applied through the Home Rule Charter. You're plucking out parts of it, which And as I said earlier, you still retain a constitutional treasurer, but that one that is controlled by a board. So I don't know that the public would understand that we are picking out parts of it, but only parts of it. I think that the Home Rule Charter really provides them with the option. You know, the sun, moon, and the stars, they get to choose whether they want three commissioners or five commissioners or what they may want in the whole context of their county government, and really provides them with more options and more choice and a more comprehensive view.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. I have Tim Lutz and Ray Erland here to testify, and then that will be it. Okay. Go ahead and start whenever you're ready. We need to kind of cook along here. We've got a big agenda ahead of us, and so, sorry, go right ahead.
Good morning, Chair Crummell, members of the committee. My name is Tim Lutz. I'm the assessor in Tillamook County. I'm the president of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. Next to me is Ray Erland, who's the Clackamas County Assessor and former president of our association. On behalf of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors, we would like to thank the committee for this opportunity to testify in regards to HB 3110. Which authorizes the governing body of the county, subject to the approval of the majority of the electors, to make the office of county assessor appointed rather than elected. The Oregon State Association of County Assessors opposes this bill because we believe it is not necessary, nor does it improve county government. Counties operate as self-governing entities through locally elected officials. The framers of the Oregon Constitution understood the need for sharing the power by designating certain offices elected positions. Some are specified in the Constitution and others by statute. They understood very well the problems associated with the concentration of political power. The citizens also provided a means for counties to change the organizational structure of county government by presenting a plan for home rule. A number of counties have presented home rule charters to their citizens. The home rule process provides the citizens the opportunity to discuss and review all functions of county government and how to balance of power should be distributed. Some counties have chosen to have a county administrator and appointed rather than elected officials, and others have continued to elect officers. Both organization styles have worked well for the citizens. However, when only one office is considered, such as assessor, the opportunity to review the total structure by the citizens is lost. In Oregon, 9 counties have chosen home rule structure of government. The citizens of those counties have reviewed the functions of county government, and 5 have chosen to appoint their assessor. The current system of 31 elected and 5 appointed assessors is working well, and the quality of both the elected and appointed assessors has never been stronger. During the 1990s, the assessors had the difficult task of implementing measures 5 and 50. While both measures were complex and dramatically changed the Oregon property tax system, assessors demonstrated the required skills and expertise to effectively make the changes and communicate with their citizens. During this period, new assessors came on board, and they, too, had the necessary skills to adapt and manage the assessment process efficiently. In summary, the current system is not broken. We believe that the current form of county government works well and that this legislation would weaken county government, not strengthen it. We are asking the committee to permanently table HB 3110. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Chair Cromwell, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ray Erlen, Clackamas County Assessor. I would add to the previous testimony, assessors have had a history of qualified individuals become an assessor. Since 1990, 18 new assessors have taken office. That seems like quite a few. It was surprising to me, but 18 have taken office since 1990. Most had experience directly in the office, and 4 were elected that had no direct experience. They had all shown that they had the necessary skills and ability to manage their offices effectively. The current system isn't broken. It seems to be working well. Citizens already have the mechanism through home rule charter to review and change the structure of their local county government. I believe this legislation is not needed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for either of these gentlemen? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on either House Bill 3110, 3109, or HJR 34? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJR 34, House Bill 3109, and House Bill 3110. Thank you very much for being here. Appreciate that. And okay, I'm going to now move to. Do we have them here? Okay. I'm going to move to a public hearing on House Bill 3600, and I have Representative Smith and Representative Flores in the room, and I'd like them to go ahead and come forward. And while Gina's bringing me the list, would you, Patrick, give us a lowdown on this bill, please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, House Bill 3600 provides that incidental fees that are prescribed by the State Board of Higher Education and the Board of Directors of the Oregon Health and Science University may not be used to pay for membership dues. The bill has an emergency clause and would take effect July 1st, 2003, should it become law. And members, we also have -1 amendments before you, and I believe some of the proponents will be speaking to those.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Flores and Representative Smith.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Linda Flores. I'm State Representative for House District 51. This morning, I am introducing this bill for your consideration, and Ron Herbison will be carrying the water. And primarily, House Bill 3600 with the -1 amendments is a housekeeping bill that clarifies the current standards established by the Attorney General and the U.S. Supreme Court, as well as the original intent of the statute. It discusses mandatory student incidental fees as that are state dollars, and it addresses mandatory student incidental fees as on-campus student to support on-campus student activities, including athletics, student government, theater, recreation programs, and student newspapers, not for independent off-campus organizations that have political or advocacy purposes. With that, I thank you very much, and I will excuse myself back to committee.
Thank you, Representative. Before you take off, are there any questions for Representative Flores? Okay.
Yes,
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Flores, how does this fee bill differ than every other fee bill we've had in subsequent sessions that have died?
Well, there is some clarification of its original intent, which we hope that you will consider well today.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Smith.
Good morning, Chair Crummell, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith. I represent District 57, which includes Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow County. And I'm proud to say I'm the State Representative for Eastern Oregon University. I'm here today kind of for an odd reason. The gentleman sitting to my left started out as a student intern in my office. Came to work as one of several members, and over the course of the last 3 months has worked his way into a position of serving as my chief of staff, and I have to tell you, is doing a phenomenal job. And the reason I share that with you is because when he started out as a student, we sat down and we had an initial conversation, and we talked about what is his role going to be working in my office, and what does he hope to gain being down here at the Capitol, essentially serving as an intern. And he shared with me some of his thoughts and ideas, and that he wanted to gain a greater understanding of the process and how politics works. And when he said that, it allowed me, or forced me, to step back and think 12 years ago when I worked for then House Majority Leader Greg Walden here at the Capitol. And one of the opportunities that the House Majority Leader allowed me was to take one issue that was important to me and allow me to work it, and to spend the necessary time bringing that issue forward. And I have to tell you, that was a tremendous experience, and I wish every student in higher education would have the same opportunity, because it truly opened my eyes, as I know it's opened Ron's eyes. I have to tell you, you have an opportunity today with House Bill 3600 to have a good discussion. Should public funds be used to lobby each and every one of us who serve in the House and the Senate? To me, that's what the policy discussion is. And I don't have the answer. I don't know. But I do support Ron and his efforts to bring this idea forward. I commend him for having the courage to step forward, because as I look through this room, there's a lot of students here who also want to have a role in this debate. And again, I think that's what's great about this building. So I want you to know I'm here today. I've read through House Bill 3600. I think you folks have a decision to make. Should public funds be used to hire folks to come lobby you? So with that said, Chair Crummell, I truly appreciate you allowing me to come forward today to sit to the left of Ron and to let you know I support his efforts. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I do have one quick question because I don't know if both of you as representatives need to scoot out, and so if you do, with the amendment, it says for political or advocacy groups, so that would, you know, probably in later testimony we're going to hear something about how that would take the students advocacy group, the Oregon Student Association, out of the equation as far as being able to be here to represent students' needs and that sort of thing. Any response to that? I mean, is that sort of your intention as sponsors of the bill, or is that going to end up being kind of an unintended consequence?
I would defer to the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that as you hear the testimony of Ron, that I believe your question will be addressed.
Okay.
And I think probably that's a good jumping off point for him to begin.
Okay, great.
What I would say, Chair Crumble, on that issue, members of the committee, is I think every student has a right to come down here and should be down here testifying on these issues. That's what Oregon is known for, free speech and the ability to come down and communicate your thoughts. The question I have is, should public dollars be used to pay for folks to come down to lobby you and I? It's a policy question. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we'll have to answer. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Just a second. Representative Pazanski and then Representative Worth.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Smith, I just want to see, I understand how you frame the question. I've looked at 3600, and I'd like to frame it a different way and ask you whether you think this is somehow usurping the democratic process on each campus as to their making decisions within their own organization, their own institution, first of all.
Chair Crummell, Vice Chair Pazanski, if I understand you correctly, by statutorily prohibiting the use of that money to be used to hire paid representatives to come down here, that's usurping the democratic process? Is that?
That's not the question. Okay. Question, let me see if I can frame it a different way. And speaking with the with Ron on this bill, he has informed me that this is basically going to preempt the use of quote-unquote membership fees to be used in groups that would potentially advocate for students in this particular case here in the Capitol. And so my question only is, my understanding that these processes are all within the university. There's a procedure that students use in their local government on each of the campuses to make determinations as to who or what they're going to fund, and there's a democratic process as who that they have to actually put this to a vote. Do you disagree with that process?
Chair Crummell, Vice Chair Pazanski, I guess I would ask us to step back for a moment and say, was it democratically voted upon to take these student fees, which amount to a significant amount of money for students, to be used for these purposes? As I understand it, every student within the higher ed system is required, whether they choose to or not, to pay that money. And so, again, I defer to this committee to address that policy issue. Is it appropriate to take those dollars without the consent of students and use them for advocacy groups that perhaps don't represent the interests of the majority of the students?
Mr. Chair,
and I have a follow-up.
Two things. I guess in response to that, it would seem like the vote of the students would have made that decision as to whether the majority was being represented or not. But let me ask you, I've received a packet. All of us have received the packet. And one of the letters that's in the packet is from the president of the Associated Students of Eastern Oregon University, Mike Fries, that he's in opposition to this bill, House Bill 3600, for various reasons. I wonder if you've seen his position that he's taken for the university that's in your district.
Vice Chair Pazanski, yes, I have. And I commend that letter coming to me, and I think that individual has every opportunity to present those thoughts. Again, I have not taken a formal position on House Bill 3600. What I am saying is, it is a good discussion for this committee to have. Is it a proper use for taxpayer dollars? And effectively, that's what this is, to be used for political lobbying.
One last one. It just appears I've got another letter that's come from Eastern Oregon University, dated the 5th of April, from the Director of Athletics and Recreation, Rob Cassell, it looks like. He also is stating his opposition to House Bill 3600. Have you had an opportunity to speak with that individual regarding the use of student fees for athletic and recreation purposes?
In answer to your question, no, I have not. But again, let me reiterate, what I'm here to do today is to say, we as a legislative body need to have the discussion. Is this appropriate?
That's kind of what I thought we were doing, but thank you. I'll pass.
Thank you. Representative Worth?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to make sure I've got this correct, that in my understanding is that this bill is not before us because of a problem brought to you, your attention, or the legislature's attention on behalf of college students or universities or even the university system, but rather it's your former intern's project. And the climate that we're in is just you know, there's only a small amount of time, and I'm just wondering if the discussion has maybe has its merits, but given, you know, the climate that we're in and the business that we have to be doing, I just want to make sure that this hasn't been brought to your attention and you're not forwarding this bill on behalf of a number of students or a group of people out of contact to do that. It is rather your interns.
Thank you, Chair Crummell, Representative Work. No, I'm here today to support the gentleman to my left and his effort in this bill. What I would point out as a point of discussion is the fact that the fees that are required by each student to pay represent a significant amount of money, and that money could potentially be used for books, tuition, and many other purposes. Again, that's a discussion for you folks.
Mr. Chair, one question.
Representative Buckin.
Thank you. We have before us in our packet letters from many of Oregon's finest higher institutions written by the presidents of those universities on letterhead, which I'm assuming was paid for by state funds. And I'm guessing that these were written during business hours, since they seem to be relatively official. And I'm wondering, as we consider whether or not public money should be used to lobby us on important issues like this, whether we should just toss these in the can or actually read them and consider them.
Chair Crummell, Representative Avakian, I assume that question's directed at me.
Well, any of the three, yes. But you brought up how important it was for us to discuss the issue. I'm curious what you think.
Well, Chair Crummell, Representative Avakian, first and foremost, I hope they're using stationery that's not color, it's in black and white, per the governor's directive. With that said, no, I think it's very important for the presidents and the deans and the associate deans to make their positions known. They do serve as the leaders of these institutes of higher education. I'd hope they'd make their opinions known, just like you and I would.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just encourage, rather than forestall the testimony that Mr. Hervison is bringing forward, it might address some of your questions and certainly the Dash 1 amendments that Vice Chair Posansky has made reference to in regard to athletics, which are not a part of the bill now as amended. And Representative Avakian, I guess it would be your decision whether you read your letters or trash them.
It would be. Okay.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to cut it off because I don't want this banter going on back and forth between the committee and other members. The question that I have, or not question, the comment that I would just point out, members, is that these letters are directed at the bill as originally posted and not with the amendments. And so I don't know what their positions would be with that, but I'm sure that when Dr. Jarvis comes up, he can probably address some of those things relative to the amendments. So thank you very much. Appreciate that. Let me have Lee Vache come up along with Ron. And Ron, go ahead and start.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming up, I just want to make a point as to the Dash 1 amendments are not part of the bill. They're for our consideration.
That's correct.
We do, in fact, need to look at the bill in its entirety as it's being presented, with or without any amendments.
Thank you. Ron, are you, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Posansky, members of the committee. Thank you for accepting my testimony and having this discussion here today. And this is not a project, as was talked about. This is actually a real issue that was brought to Representative Flores by a significant group on all the public university campuses in the state of Oregon. Yes, as this bill is written currently, it will prohibit membership dues being paid into NCAA, NAIA. Yes, it will prohibit membership dues being paid into national educational societies. But we must understand, we all, as members and staff of this body, understand the intricacies of how a bill becomes a law. There is more to it than that little diagram on the legislator's webpage. There's a lot more to it. We all understand the relationships each member's office has to have with legislative council. We have to understand the deadlines and the pressure that is placed on legislative council as these deadlines approach. This is why we also understand that Midge down legislative council, her favorite type of chocolate is dark chocolate. I've used that a couple times. This is why we have this process, so we can fix the bill. This bill came out of legislative council right at the deadline. We did not have time to take it back to legislative council to get it fixed. As soon as we got this bill, we put the amendments down into legislative council to get the Dash 1 amendments, which you have before you, which will only apply this bill to membership dues being paid into political or advocacy groups. It was never the intent to affect athletic affiliations. It never was. I have received letters, and I have talked with many people about athletic affiliations, recreational programs, those memberships. I received a letter from Portland State University athletic director Tom Berman on this issue, and I called him yesterday, and I talked to him about this, and I told him that, well, when you were discussing about this opinion, did organizations tell you about the Dash 1 amendments that they have for this, that they have known for a while? He said, no, I don't know of any amendments that are being pending on this bill. And I told him about these amendments, and he goes, oh, then I have no problem with the bill. It doesn't affect athletics. I have no problem. This will not affect athletics with the Dash 1 amendments, and that's what's important. This bill will also not affect the broad range of activities that is intended to fund, such as other recreational programs, student newspapers, student union facilities, programs bringing speakers to campus, cultural events involving art, music, drama, film showings. Now, we emphasize these programs. These are on-campus programs. And when we look at the 1985 Attorney General opinion, as well as the 2000 Supreme Court opinion in University of Wisconsin versus Southworth, there's an emphasis here on campus activities. And as we go through these, the Attorney General opinion, which was wrote by now University of Oregon President Dave Frohnmayer, when he was Attorney General back in 1985, we will see that these compulsory fees cannot be used for political or advocacy purposes, especially in an off-campus nature. And this bill is not a new idea. This is just a housekeeping bill. It incorporates and clarifies current standards established in the 1985 Attorney General's opinion and the U.S. Supreme Court opinion. We need to look at the authorization of the fees to understand. These fees are paid by all university students on the OUS system to pay for student activities. The authorization is found under ORS 351-070, and I'm glad there's not the little piggy bank here so I can use acronyms.
We can change that.
This statute states the Oregon State Board of Higher Education is authorized to prescribe incidental fees for programs under the supervision or control of the board found by the board upon its own recommendation or upon recommendation of the recognized student government of the institution concerned to be advantageous to the cultural or physical development of the students. No one's denying that such activities, such that are artistic or recreational, those are supposed to be funded by this fee. No one's denying that. The language of this statute becomes very important. We have to look at the legislative intent. Back in 1973 was when this amendment to the statute came in by Senator Newbery, and it was Senate Bill 47 at the time, in the 1973 session before the House and Senate Education Committees. We look back and we look at the testimony there, and it is important to note this because of this is what shows what the legislature decided, the language here. At culture and physical development, it includes a wide spectrum of artistic, humanitarian, and intellectual endeavors. We must note that the language does not state political or ideological in nature. That was not the intent of the legislature for this specific statute. There is another statute which I will be getting to, which authorizes optional fees, which are intent to use for those type of purposes. When we look at the 1985 Attorney General opinion, the first question that is asked in the opinion is, can mandatory students' incidental fees be used to fund an organization which takes a definite, which advocates definite positions on ballot measures before the Oregon voters? That is the first question we have to ask ourselves. And this question is actually really easy to answer. The answer is no. Arguably, it could be cultural physical development. But because these are state dollars, they are bound by another Oregon statute, RS-260-432, which forbids public funds to be used to support or oppose measures before Oregon voters.
Okay, I need you to get right to the point relative to the bill itself. Not whether it's going out. This bill is not going to the voters. This bill is going to the House of Representatives if it gets
anywhere. I understand.
I need to address that.
I understand. It's important to understand that these mandatory student settled fees cannot be used for purposes of political or ideological nature. It was never the intent, and this bill will no way infringe on students' First Amendment's rights. If anything, using these fees for that purpose will infringe on those rights.
Representative Ron, I'm going to beg to differ with you. I've got an opinion in front of me, and under the next set of questions, D through B, the answer is yes. The a deputy Department of Justice attorney lays out what the parameter is, and then the next paragraph, the last requirement, must be satisfied for the expenditure to survive sensitive constitutional free speech and association challenges available to students who disagree with political and ideological activities funded by the compulsory fees.
These fees, the compulsory fees have to be used in a manner that is culturally advantageous to the students, such as bringing maybe controversial speakers on campus. There's an emphasis here of on-campus activities. This fee is not supposed to be used for off-campus advocacy, and this fee can only be used for organizations that are and programs that are under the supervision and control of the State Board of Higher Education. They cannot be used for independent political or ideological advocacy organizations. That's what we have to distinguish here. If it is to bring a speaker on campus to be culturally advantageous, yes, these fees are supposed to be that because a university is a public forum and a great marketplace of ideas. That's what the fee is intended to do. It cannot be used for off-campus independent political or advocacy organizations. That is very key here. Those organizations, there's also in the statute in 351 the use of optional fees. The distinction here is between mandatory fees and optional fees is very important. The mandatory fees, the compulsory fees, which are paid by everybody, and if these go to an interest group of a narrow clientele, you are infringing on a student's right who disagrees with that organization. And it's specifically noted in here in Senator Newberry's testimony that these organizations cannot get funding. These are for culturally and physically advantageous programs on campus. And yes, it can be used to bring speakers, to bring political, during campaigns, to bring parties into debate. That's the purpose, because it's supposed to enhance the university's public forum and marketplace of ideas. It's not supposed to go and use the money for independent off-campus organizations to lobby the legislature, to lobby the Oregon voters. Now, I fully encourage students to come down here. And if the student governments want to have an optional fee to fund those organizations, they can. They are not bound by the statute that says to be culturally or physically advantageous to the students with the optional fee. They only have to get the institution's executive. They don't even have to get the Oregon State Board of Higher Education to approve those fees.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Kitts.
Ron, we seem to have this debate about what they can or can't be used for. My question is, I'm looking at your -1 amendments here, and it says, after dues, insert for political or advocacy groups.
Yes.
How would you define advocacy groups? I mean, that's, and I'll tell you, I'm biased. I was an NCAA athlete.
Mm-hmm.
So you better hope this doesn't affect that.
No, this this will absolutely not affect NCAA, NAIA. This will absolutely not affect educational societies. Advocacy groups.
Give me an example of a couple advocacy groups that this would directly affect.
OSPRG, Oregon Students of Color Coalition, Oregon Student Association, Oregon Federation of College Republicans.
Okay, now I'll stop you right there. My concern is while I'm obviously not a member of the Oregon Students of Color Association, there are some folks that are.
Yes. However, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, the compulsory student fees are paid by everybody. They cannot be used for an advocacy organization of such a narrow clientele. They have to be viewpoint neutral, and that is expressed in Southworth as well as the Attorney General's opinion. And political and advocacy groups are by nature not viewpoint neutral.
May I follow up?
Yes, you may. And then Representative Brzezinski.
I'll go ahead and defer to the representative.
No, that's what I would really like to do is let these guys get done, and then ask them questions if you have questions, and then let's get on with it because I've got more people on here, and we have more business on our agenda. Ron, I'm going to ask you to wrap up so you can get to Mr. Veche, and we can move on.
I'll withdraw my follow up.
Thank you.
Okay, the very crucial part that we have to understand is that there are two fees prescribed in the Oregon statute. For students. One is compulsory and mandatory that has to be paid by every single student. That has to go to fund programs and organizations that are advantageous to the culture and physical development of the students and interpretations of on campus. They need to be on campus and to meet the requirements of being advantageous to the entire campus community, not a specific clientele. Not a narrow clientele. They also have to be viewpoint neutral by Southworth, which is political and advocacy groups and not viewpoint neutral by nature, and that is why this is a housekeeping bill. It just incorporates and clarifies those that intent and the intent of the original statute. And that will do. And I'll
thank you. Mr. Veche?
I'm Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lee Veche, and I'm the state chairman of the Oregon Federation of College Republicans, which is just one of these organizations that we're describing here, of off-campus, independent. We do lobbying. We do political advocacy. And our organization contends that it is not acceptable for student fees to be sent to any off-campus organization to be used for lobbying purposes where there is no oversight of the students who are paying those fees. There's no accountability to the students. They are sent to these ominous off-campus offices where students don't know where their dollars are being spent. And when it comes particularly to this iffy question of money being spent on political advocacy, which the Supreme Court has addressed numerous times, that is a section that must have strict oversight and those dollars need to be spent with accountability. Now, if student governments wish to lobby on their own behalf on campus, spending on-campus representatives to the legislature, that would certainly be with an organization as a good thing. It is simply this elusive off-campus nature of an organization that receives tens of thousands of dollars in student fees that is not proper and not right. My organization does not receive student fees. Our state association of college Republican chapters, of which we have one on each of the seven state university systems in addition to the private schools, and have upwards of 1,000 members. And we simply feel that if an off-campus group like this wants to advocate political viewpoints, they need to raise their own dollars and do so on their own time, not on the time and dollar of the students of Oregon.
Thank you. I have a quick question for you, Mr. Veche. Does a Federation of College Republicans receive student fee funds?
Several of our campus organizations do receive funds. None of those funds are sent to our state federation. So the organization which I chair does not receive. Some local college Republican chapters do.
Do you think that that the local chapters, for example, the College Republicans at University of Oregon, should receive student fees?
As long as those dollars are spent on viewpoint point neutral programs, it is acceptable. If you were to bring a political candidate and buy the speakers and host the event using student fee dollars to host a partisan viewpoint, that I would say is unacceptable. But to host nonpartisan speakers is acceptable, and to do programs which simply raise ideas on campus is acceptable, but the strict partisanship is not, and that those dollars are carefully watched on campus through the university fee systems to make sure the dollars are spent according to the law.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You gave a litany of the groups that your bill would not affect, and I don't see anywhere in your testimony an identification of the political or advocacy groups that your bill does target, and it would actually be defunded.
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, the organizations that would not be able to get the mandatory student incidental fees would be state organizations, off-campus state organizations, such as Oregon Students of Color Coalition.
Right, excuse me.
But
don't you have a list of actually the groups that are out there existing right now that this bill would affect?
Those are the type of organizations it will affect.
All right. But
and yes, we do have a list.
I'd like that list. And I have to say for the record, the only group, off-campus group I've ever seen up here at the Capitol is the OSU Republicans. I've not been lobbied by any outside off-campus groups at all. Nor have I been lobbied by the OSU Republicans, but it's the only presence I've seen up here.
Come talk to me. Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you. Just a couple of questions regarding, since one of the groups is Osberg, I know that they've gone through at the University of Oregon funding and defunding at least twice in the last 8 years, and I think recently have been defunded. My understanding is the way that process actually does work is that there is a student government budget hearings. They go through that process. They determine whether they're going to fund that organization. And at one point, that organization did not provide proper accounting, and they were defunded.
Mm-hmm.
Then they came back, broke their funds out, showed where their money was going, and the students agreed that they wanted that organization to be funded. So isn't there already the check and balance in place with student government for these fees so they can, in fact, make certain they are accountable to the students who have voted to fund those programs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, it's not the statutorily accountability that is required. And when we look at the legislative history, Senator Newbery specifically mentions Osberg as not being able to get any of the funds of the any of the mandatory fees. He specifically names them, and for that we go back to the minutes of the House and Senate Education Committees for the 1973 session. He specifically names them, as well as it is a misstatement to say that the students have complete control over their funds. We go back to the minutes of the testimony from those committees as well, where President Mac Vicker, who was president of Oregon State University at the time, was asked by Senator Fadley, to what extent will student government have the power to decide how mandatory student incidental fees are spent? President Mac Vicker replied, when you say decide, they will not. It's only a recommendation. The final decision has to stay with the Oregon State Board of Higher Education because they are the ones authorized to prescribe the fee, and they can be held personally liable for it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Brzezinski.
A couple of things. Number one, I believe that level can actually delegate to the individual institutions, and the institutions can, in fact, take it upon themselves. Let me just follow up on a couple of the statements you've also made regarding the Attorney General opinion. You talked about Dave Frommeyer, who is now the president of the University of Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding, when you look at the Southwark decision and when the school reviewed it as to what the U.S. Supreme Court said in that particular decision, it is the opinion of that institution that it does not, in fact, the process that they have on campus at the University of Oregon violates Southworth. Other, let me ask you this. Isn't it true that Southworth actually says that the fees committees must have a viewpoint that's neutral in the allocation process and not that the groups that receive them, meaning the funds?
Chair Crummell, Representative Brzezinski, it says both. I've talked with constitutional law professors here at Willamette as well as at Eastern Oregon University. It says both. The process has to be viewpoint neutral, as well as the organizations have to be viewpoint neutral.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let me have Chancellor Dr. Jarvis come on up, if you would, please. And along with him, can we have Greg Mangus and Jason Thielen? Or I guess whoever you have decided to bring with you. Forget those other people.
Good control. I love it.
Did you like that recovery? That was, you know, we try to give the rest of the Capitol some entertainment here in general government as well.
Extremely well done, Mr. Chairman. Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Richard Jarvis. I'm the Chancellor of the Oregon University System, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on this bill. I'd like to be very clear that as Chancellor, I'm speaking for the President and for the State Board of Higher Education in delivering a very strong opposition to this bill. We regard it as an assault on the fundamental principle that guides higher education, and that is academic freedom. Our communities are places of many voices. We're loud and noisy places. This is a bill that's about silence, about prior restraint, and it is antithetical to the creation, debate, and synthesis of new knowledge. We believe it's a direct assault on the principles of democracy and the right of self-determination of our students. You know, the average age of our students is 25.6 years. The vast majority of them work. The vast majority of them pay taxes, and we believe they have a very good right and a very good experience to determine how they collect these dollars, how they distribute them, and how they serve their interests. It's the marketplace of ideas that are the hallmarks of our universities. And that university is advanced by the choices of students in the groups that they organize, the interests that they represent, and how they fund themselves with their own dollars. Passage of this bill would send a chilling message on academic freedom to other public universities around our country. And, you know, we're struggling to recruit and retain students here in Oregon. We're struggling to recruit and retain students and faculty from across the country. And I would ask you not to send that chilling message out around our state and across our country. It is surely the ability of our own students to collect and distribute these funds through democratic processes that is an essential element of their civic engagement. And where would we want to encourage that more than on the campuses of your public universities? Please do not proceed with the passage and support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Jarvis.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Grattan Terrence, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon University System, and just a couple of items to help have the committee understand how the process works. The authority under Chapter 351.070 does, in fact, say that the board has the authority, but that authority has been and is, as a general rule, delegated to the campuses and is there shared with the students who have the fundamental and direct authority over the raising of, the disbursement of, and the responsibility for accounting for those dollars. And that any involvement by the state board in the last, well, since this statute was created, is ministerial or pro forma in nature. And there is no record, to my knowledge, and I've asked general counsel for the Oregon University System if there has been an example where the board has interdicted a decision by a student government in the raising of and appropriation of, through their democratic processes, these fees, and his answer is no. And thus would say that there's hard to find a problem to be addressed with this bill when the bill itself represents a severe and, I would suspect, probably constitutional problem for the processes that are used to raise and disperse these dollars.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions for either of these gentlemen? Representative Worth?
Thank you both for coming. I appreciate you lending your voice on this issue. And I'm kind of with you, Grattan, that I kind of look at this as a solution looking for a problem. So my intuition would be to guess that there are a small number of specific political or advocacy groups that have caused a lot of angst amongst students on certain universities. Is there a small handful or a limited number of particular groups that have caused more of an uproar than others?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Worth, that's the uproar and problem is in the eye of the beholder. You can find on any campus someone who doesn't like something. And in fact, that is the essence of what's being discussed here in this measure and the remarks of the chancellor. There are ways for students to control their own dollars if they feel offended and harmed, and there are ways for students to advocate for expenditure of their fees for groups and issues of their own interest. And it's a democratic process which is followed through by student self-determination. And yes, there are always someone who will be offended by something, but it's those many voices that make for a very rich and robust intellectual atmosphere for students to begin to create the personal values that will guide them through their lives. And it is not the silencing of groups, but rather the encouragement of groups that will result in the stronger intellectual fiber of those students. And some will be offended, and they will be offended in their adult lives as they go forward. But this bill is not a measure that would... it goes back to a now abandoned principle of in loco parentis, which we have abandoned in public higher education. This would attempt to reimpose it, and as the chancellor said, for an average age of 25 and a half years old for a student body is simply doesn't make any practical sense. And the last thing I would say is that the amendment to the measure is an invitation to litigation by virtue of the use of the imprecise word of advocacy. I don't know how long you want to take trying to define it, but I can guarantee you that there are undoubtedly good lawyers who would spend lots of dollars trying to determine what that is in litigation going forward, and I would suggest that you might want to avoid that on behalf of the university system and the limited dollars we have, and on behalf of the students and the dollars that they are taxing themselves for.
I'm sure that if we had five lawyers in here, which I know we have two, we could probably have seven different opinions. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Grattan, I guess I want to just kind of expand this outside of the university to another model and tell me if you think this would be a fair analysis. For each of us who live in cities, we pay city taxes. The city has individuals that may be on their books to actually do lobbying and bring forward to this body their positions. But they also, if I'm not mistaken, pay some fees or dues or memberships to other organizations such as the League of Cities to have people come in and advocate for us. Those are tax dollars. Those are public money. Are all these cities in violation by under the analysis that's being used by the proponents of this bill?
Well, you could extend that to them if you wished, I think that would be an analogous situation. They're not addressed by this, but they are certainly analogous. Mr. Chairman and Representative Prezonsky, I'm a registered lobbyist, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. And I am supported by state general fund dollars, but my job is advocacy on behalf of the interests of the university system, and should I be addressed by legislation? At what point do we say we don't want to hear from people because we think we don't want to hear what they have to say, or do we want to hear from all and have a reasoned debate and synthesis of what is the truth at that time? And I would argue, and we would argue, for letting all voices be heard and synthesize the truth of the day to be tested tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Okay, let me have Greg Mangus, Jason Thielen, and Naomi Hines come on up, please.
Good morning, Chair Crumble, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Magnus, and I'm the president of the Associated Students of Western Oregon University. I'm here today in opposition of House Bill 3600, which would ban student fees from going to the dues for political or advocacy groups. This bill appears intended to stop students from using their student fees to engage in partisan political activity, an activity from which student fees are already prohibited. But the bill goes much further. House Bill 3600 would essentially make illegal the current nonpartisan advocacy student governments like Western's conduct on behalf of the student body. To help illustrate this point, I would like to quickly share with you a few lines from our ASWU Constitution. Article 1, the student government. The student body of Western Oregon University shall be known as the Associated Students of Western Oregon University. Any student who pays incidental fees to Western Oregon University is a member of ASWU. Subsection 1.2. There is created a student government. Such student government represents the interests of ASWU. The first section clearly states that each student is a member of ASWU. The dues each student pays go to fund the student government that represents the interests of the students, as stated in subsection 1.2. House Bill 3600 would essentially be the state government telling the students working in student governments at every public university that it is no longer acceptable for you to advocate on behalf of the students that they represent. The students at Western University pay these fees that go to the student government and have an expectation that they are getting advocacy for the money they pay. This legislation would make the expectation impossible to fulfill. Another problem with House Bill 3600 is that the language it uses is so broad it seems likely to carry serious unintended consequences. Earlier this year, the Legislative Fiscal Office analyzed a proposal to cut the portion of the incidental fee going to political groups. The LFO response was that a proposal to eliminate only the portion of the incidental fee supporting political groups would result in far lower savings to students and would be difficult to define and legally implement. House Bill 3600 would likely face the same problems as it simply adds advocacy to the ban on the political work. Language so broad seems as though it would have sweeping unintended consequences. This bill also seems to seek to put in statute an issue already resolved by an attorney general opinion we have operated under since 1985. The ruling affirms that final authority for incidental fees and how they are used rests with the board of the Oregon University system. The ruling goes on to say that the board and its delegates therefore should not authorize use of incidental fee funds by any groups or organization to intervene or participate in any campaign, to endorse or oppose a candidate, or to take a position on any issue in an election campaign or for the purpose of assisting or opposing a candidate. Partisan political activity is already prohibited, making this bill unnecessary, unless its intention is to keep students from advocating on such issues as funding for the universities we attend, or supporting the financial aid programs many students need to complete their education. This is what the students expect from their elected officers, and I have trouble understanding why such advocacy would be seen as objectionable. Student governments at public four-year institutions around Oregon have a long tradition of valuable advocacy on behalf of students on campus and in the Capitol. House Bill 3600 would end this tradition and make it impossible for us to represent students in a meaningful way. I urge the committee to reject this legislation. I thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning. Chair Crummell, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify for you today. My name is Jason Phelan. I'm the Vice President of the Associated Students of Southern Oregon University and last year's Student Fee Committee Chair. With me is Naomi Hines, Southern Oregon University Student Fee Committee current member, as well as the Vice Chair, elected Vice Chair, of the Oregon Federation of College Republicans. In addition to being an active member of SAU student government, I'm a proud college Republican. Although some college Republicans apparently requested the bill, I couldn't disagree more with this proposal. To ask the legislature to silence students' voices on issues directly affecting campus would be a profound step backwards for all Oregon students in public higher education. This session, students are faced with serious threats to the affordability and the quality of their education caused by plummeting state revenues. This is the issue that I hear most about from the students who elected me. This bill does not address this issue at all. It simply ties the hands of elected representatives at a time when what students need most are representatives or vigorous representation. Through the advocacy work of student governments and the statewide student association, students have claimed many victories for public higher education in the state legislature. I have yet to talk to a student who believes we could have been better off with no organized student voice calling for a free tuition as we did in 1997 and 1999. No student has told me it should be illegal for student government and the statewide student association to advocate for adequate funding for the university that they attend. This isn't to say that those students aren't out there and that they have those opinions. But students who disagree with how their fees are spent have a very effective mechanism to get their opinions heard. This mechanism is an election held annually on campuses across the state in order to make sure that the people who are allocating these student fees are representing the views of the student body. All students, furthermore, have the opportunity to participate in an open hearing process that is modeled after the one used here in Salem. All students currently have an equal opportunity to participate in this process. So again, I believe House Bill 3600 is a solution in search of a problem. Overall, students have acted diligently and fairly to effectively execute the student fee process. I think it's worth noting that the student fee has risen at a slower rate than other resource fees around the state. And at Southern, we've dropped our student fee $1.50. I believe this is because those who pay the fee are the best to understand the consequences of an increase. In closing, I will simply say that the student fee process is a process that works. It is there to protect all viewpoints, and it is a critical component of our education. In the context of real problems facing students this session, to unnecessarily tamper with a process that works only creates distraction from much more serious problems. 2 years ago, the Supreme Court gave its unanimous support to this process, and I urge this committee to do the same today. Thank you again for the time.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. As Jason said, I speak to you as not only a senator for Southern Student Government, but as a member of the Student Fee Committee, as the current executive director for the campus chapter of the College Republicans, and as the current elected vice chair for the state organization. To save everyone's time and energy, I will simply say this bill is a very bad idea. What it does is attempts to silence voices that some don't agree with, rather than to try to raise their own. After going through the student fee process this year, what I saw was one of the most democratic and well-administered processes I've seen on campus or anywhere else. Students that wished to speak their mind had the opportunity. Groups were heard, groups were scrutinized on three different levels of committee structure, and decisions were made. Fees were appropriated on a basis of where these students felt their money would be best spent. If we put a restriction on this, what we are doing is silencing the student voice. It's unfortunate that in an attempt to silence what some see as over-activist organizations and these off-campus groups, what we really will be doing is silencing on-campus voice. For example, if I was to want to take my College Republicans to the state convention, with this bill, I would not be able to request student fee money to attend that convention because it would constitute contributing to the Oregon Federation of College Republicans. I would also like to point out that much of the lobbying and much of the effort for activacy is done on a campus level, and there are groups we have that would be well within their rights to request fee money who do significant lobbying of local officials and even come up to Salem every now and then, and they would still get their funding. So this bill wouldn't do anything. It would just be additional red tape and an additional burden to student voice. So I urge you to vote against this on the basis that it is simply not needed and in essence will not even accomplish what it is intended to accomplish. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair, I do.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to thank you all for being up here, and I regret that this bill has demanded so much time and effort on the part of all these students here and the higher ed advocates that we've heard from today, and it's too bad that we've diverted all you from the fight to what we really need to be having, which is for higher ed funding. So my question is direct and it's simple. Do you know of anyone that you've spoken with or heard of, aside from the proponents who have spoken to us today, who support this bill?
In conversations on campus, I have followed the entire fee process, gone to every meeting. I have not had anybody come out publicly and tell me that this is a good idea. No one, I think, would come out publicly and on our campus in Ashland and say that this is a good idea. It has not been an experience of this process.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me have Christian Mathias and Andy Schultz. Is it Schultz or Schultz? Schultz. And I'm going to ask you to keep your comments brief. If you have written testimony, then just surmise it or summarize it, please.
Mr. Chair, can we get staff to come help us with our folders? I can see that they're going to be quite full.
Yes, I think you can call your staff to come on down and help you with it, Representative.
And this would be my staff here. I'm sorry to say.
Chair Crumbull and members of the committee, my name is Christian Matthias, and for the record, I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 3600. I do have a written testimony that I was prepared to read, but for the sake of time, I will spare you, and I will.
And I would point out if you agree with something that somebody else has said, just say you agree with them, and then move on. Thank you.
I fully agree with the previous three students that just sat here, and I would like to add one additional comment, that is the integrity of our fees process, as democratic as it is, supports the co-curricular student experience on campus. The co-curricular activities have vastly improved the lives of students and also the marketability of students in the job field. Often when employers look at two or more candidates that are competing for a position, we find that they look at equally rated candidates based on whether or not the co-curricular activities demonstrate their ability to apply whatever degree they're seeking. Our student incidental fees support and augment the co-curricular experience, and if the democracy of that process is compromised, we will no longer have co-curricular experiences to back up our students' degrees. And ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, that limits the future of Oregon students and Oregon's future altogether.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Crummell, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Saltz, and I'm the vice chair of the Oregon Student Association and also a student at Oregon State, serving as the chief of staff for the Associated Students of Oregon State University. I'm going to make it real brief, too. I just handed out 325 support statements, and we got those in about a week from across the state. From different students on campus. And there's also about 20 students in the overflow room that I don't know if they've come over here or not. So anyway, the Oregon Student Association opposes this House Bill 3600. OSA will be one of the organizations directly affected by this in its current form. I want to take the opportunity to introduce some of my fellow board members that are here today that have made the trip. Greg Magnus, who testified earlier, the student body president from Western Oregon. Rebecca Wilcox, the state and federal affairs director from the Associated Students of Western Oregon University. Miriam Gonzalez, the state affairs director for the Associated Students of Portland State University. Adam Petkin, the state affairs task force director at the Associated Students of University of Oregon. And Chris Perrault, the state task force director at OSU. Our board is made up of 18 members, two members from each campus that the Oregon Student Association represents, which includes Southern Oregon University, Eastern Oregon University, Portland State, Western, Oregon State, OIT, University of Oregon, Lane Community College, and OHSU. The student body president of each university sits on our board as well as a designee appointed by them. The Oregon Student Association was established in 1975 to represent, serve, and protect the collective interest of students in post-secondary education.
Can I ask you to summarize,
yeah,
please?
I mean, basically,
I know you kind of started getting into
a lot of people, and to my understanding, the presidents did know about the Dash 1 amendments, and I know that was a discussion.
They did know about them?
That was my understanding,
okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for your
and time. Even with the Dash 1 amendments, you would be opposed to the bill?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to bring that up. Okay.
Chair Crumbull,
great, thank you.
Could I add one more item?
Sure.
Okay.
I'd like to, as long as it's brief.
It is brief.
I'm going to lose my committee here, and I've got some more things I've got to get done. So
I would like to respond to the students that approached you earlier that said that these organizations that lobby and advocate are a narrow clientele. I think that the reason that they're a narrow clientele is because students have simply chosen not to get involved in the democratic process.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
Representative Prezanski.
Just one suggestion. Saving paper may save a little money, and if we had them actually duplex, I could probably use the clip that was left on my desk to take them back with me. But thank you very much.
Great.
Should
thank
we
you.
Reduce?
Are there any questions for these gentlemen?
Right.
Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3600. Thank you very much for being here. But, before you leave, I'm going to ask you to please leave quiet, because I know you're all going to exit now. Please leave very quietly, because I have some more things I've got to get done, and I can't do it with all the noise. Okay?
Can they cheer out in the hall?
They can do whatever they want to out in the hall.
Touch anything.
Just don't do it in here. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3380. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3380. I'm going to open a public hearing on. Have we called? We can do that.
They're right out.
Shetterly and those guys. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2278. And Dave, in the interest of time, while we're waiting for the representative to get here, you want to just come on up? Is Wendy going to come with you?
No, I see her coming in right now, so that would be fine. And then what I'll do is that when Representative, I want you, I'll just have you and Wendy come up together, and then when Representative Shetterly gets here, I'm just going to have him come up and sit next to you. I'm going to break you for a moment to, so that he can speak. Or do you want to have Dave Hendricks come up? Okay. That'd be fine. I forgot to see if Patrick wanted to tell us about this bill. Dave, why don't you, or Dave, or Dave, why don't you go ahead and tell us about this bill?
Please, Dave. Go ahead.
Sure. Chair Crummell, members of the committee, Dave Hendrick, Deputy Legislative Counsel. House Bill 2278 is a bill, product of the Oregon Law Commission. It's part of an ongoing project which was started last session with the passage of a bill that created a set of uniform definitions for various kinds of public bodies under the ORS. This 2278 was an attempt to start applying some of those definitions to some of the existing laws and to bring some conformity into the terminology used in the various statutes. And the parameter set for 2278 was essentially the statutes governing districts, the various kinds of special districts. One of the terms that were defined by the bill last session, which is now ORS 174-116, which is section one of your bill, was a definition of what a district was. As you can see, we have a couple of little tweaks to that definition to pick up a couple of entities that were missed in the listing to try to get a comprehensive list. And then the remainder of the bill is basically going through the statutes governing the various types of districts and substituting the new terminology, the new terms that are used by the law, now codified as 174-108 to 174-118, and also just to update and make more uniform some of the other references that beyond the specific terms that were used in those in that series. I'll turn it over to
Representative Shetterly is who you'll turn it over to.
I will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23. What have we done?
Just explain what the bill does.
Okay. Well, I will just thank you for hearing it today and ask your prompt and favorable action. And I guess partly, too, I would just make a couple of comments about the Law Commission, since usually the Law Commission brings its bills to the Judiciary Committee and doesn't have the pleasure of visiting other committees. But just so you know, the Commission is an important and becoming more important aspect of the lawmaking process here in Oregon. It was created in 1997 to conduct a continuous program of law revision and reform and improvement. And it we worked in concert between Willamette University, where the Executive Director's Office is housed, and also with Legislative Council that does our drafting for the commission. We have 13 commissioners, four legislative members, the governor's appointee, the deans of the three law schools of that are in Oregon, and four members appointed by the Oregon State Bar Association, as well as the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and the Attorney General are members of the commission. We meet on a regular basis during the year, and we have several work groups dealing with issues all through the interim, and actually then with through that we involve, I think, more than 200 lawyers and judges as volunteers in working on the array of issues that the commission deals with. I know your time is short because the floor is starting and I'm carrying the first bill, so I will just about cut my testimony off with that. But I just express, again, thanks for hearing this, and I hope that I think what you'll see in this session, the number of commission bills is increasing in each of the three sessions that we've been active, and it really is becoming, I think, a very integral and important part of the lawmaking process here in Oregon. David Kanagi, of course, being the executive director, very capable, and we're grateful to Willamette University for their support in this. But we all benefit from the work of the commission. I'm pleased to be associated with it, and I thank you for your time.
Any questions for the representative?
And in fact, the bill that I have to carry is a commission bill. That's another one of the eminent domain bills on the floor.
If you could be so kind and speak for a very long time on your bill,
yeah,
we'll make sure we can get up there to vote on it.
I'll do my best. Maybe I'll read it.
Or have Max Lane start.
David, do you want to go ahead and get started?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Dave Kanegi. I'm Associate Dean at the Willamette University College of Law and Executive Director of the Oregon Law Commission. In the interest of time, I have no further comments.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
I would, however, like to introduce Wendy Johnson, who is our Assistant Executive Director. If there are questions on the substance of the bill, Deputy Legislative Counsel Dave Hendricks can respond. And I would like to introduce the person who chaired the work group for the Law Commission. That's Professor Bernie Vail from the Northwestern College of Law at Lewis and Clark.
Great. Thank you. Did you have a comment?
The only comment was, since we are supposed to be on the board, Dave, I know that you want to give us the full mail bill, maybe just a little bit on the side orders.
One last thing about Oregon Law Commission bills, you should get a full report with them with a section-by-section analysis, which you should have.
Great.
Which means I probably don't need to do that at this point.
That would be correct. You don't need to.
Chair Cumberland, do you have the -3 amendments before you?
Yes.
With those amendments, it is a consensus bill.
Okay. Great. Thank you. That's what I needed to know. Thank you very much. Robin Freeman, you want to come on up?
Good morning.
Good morning.
From all members of the committee, I'll keep this very brief. Robin Freeman, representing the Oregon People's Utility District Association. We support the -3 amendments, and I especially wanted to thank Representative Crummell for allowing us to work with the Oregon Law Commission and work through some issues we had with this bill.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on House Bill 2278? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2278. Do I have a quorum? I do. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2278. Representative Mabry?
I would move the -3 amendments to the bill.
Thank you. Representative Mabry moves the -3 amendments to 2278. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? So ordered. Representative Mabry?
I would move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Mabry moves House Bill 2278 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Ginny, you want to call the roll, please?
Aye.
Excused?
Aye.
Excused?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2278, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed on to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Przanski, would you be interested in carrying this? Oh, wait, never mind. I'm gonna ask Representative Shetterly to carry this, since he is on the Law Commission.
That'd be great.
And so I'll have him do that, okay? Thank you very much. For that, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2278. I'm going to open a work session, public hearing on House Bill 3319. We have proponents here for that, or are you an opponent for it, or do you care? Thank you. Let's see. We don't. Are you opponents for it? Let me have you come up first. And Patrick, do you want to tell us real briefly what this bill does?
House Bill 3319 eliminates the appropriation of the 1% of monies for construction or alteration of state buildings for an arts acquisition program and creates an arts education fund and directs the Legislative Assembly to fund it equal to 1% of expenditures of construction or alteration of state buildings. It directs the Department of Education to allocate those monies in the Arts Education Fund to school districts and to public charter schools for arts education, declares an emergency, and takes effect July 1st, 2003. And we have -1 amendments in your packets.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mardale Dunsworth with the Oregon Department of Education. I've not seen the -1 amendments. I just wanted to give you a little bit of testimony on the bill.
Okay.
The department's willing and able to distribute the funds allocated for the Arts Foundation should the bill pass. There will be a fiscal impact to the department around $43,000. An amendment that we would like to see to the bill would be the definition of the arts. Students can meet art standards through several disciplines, through music, theater, dance, and literary arts, as well as the visual arts. And the bill limits this, the use of these funds to just the visual arts, so we would encourage that small amendment.
Okay. Thank you. And to include the visual arts, you said?
It's limited to the visual arts right now, and we would encourage the addition of music, theater, dance, literary arts, and cinema in order to align with the academic standards and the Certificate of Initial Mastery.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Chair.
Appreciate that. Yes, Representative Krasinski.
I just want to make certain, is it with the Department of Education?
Yes.
And are you taking a position on the bill?
We're neutral on it. We will implement the funding cycle if you pass the bill.
I understand. I just want to make, because if you had taken a position and support, I was going to ask you a question, but since you're staying neutral, I won't ask it.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Randy, are you here in support of this bill?
Yes.
It is. I would like you to come up, please. I need to have generally we have the proponents go first, so since you're a proponent.
I was, for the record, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Hildebrand, Chief of Staff for the Senate Republican Office. I was hoping that staff from Representative Zahner's office would be down to testify today on this bill. Nicole Brigato, who had this bill drafted, with some discussion with Senator Clarno. At this difficult budgetary times, as you're all well aware of, we need to be looking at all sources of funds for K-12 education. And along with Nicole, we kind of came up with the idea of not only supporting schools through art funding, but also possibly eliminating a funding source for capital construction that's maybe not the appropriate use of state funds. As you know, for many years there has been a statute on the books that requires capital construction projects to have 1% of their budget used for that purpose distributed to artists around the state, I think through a grant process, whereas the 1% amount goes to the building in question to help decorate. And we kind of came up with the idea that we could have school children possibly have art projects to decorate the building. So I don't want you to think through this process, at least in my mind, that we would take a lot of the decoration of our state buildings away from those agencies. We would simply have K-12 school children participate in that process where they would not only get the benefit of the funding through this mechanism, but also get the benefit of seeing their art projects on the wall, maybe a DHS building or something like that. And I know that the schools in Beaverton and Corvallis and other areas around the state would really like to see this money go to teachers. So I'd like to propose that this is a choice you can make today on whether you want to fund school teachers or artists throughout the state of Oregon. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Nicole Brigato to testify.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Randy, I guess it seems like you're giving us an either-or. Can we do both? I mean, can't we, in fact, actually, if we want to in this body, both the House of Representatives and the Senators, provide for funding for education at the level that we deem appropriate without interfering with the art projects that have been ongoing and providing permanent art for buildings and structures?
That's not the message I got from the January 28th vote. The message I received from the voters of Oregon is they feel that we need to make better use of our dollars and not raise taxes. And I firmly believe when working with the school boards and others that they want to see about a $5.5 billion allocation to K-12 schools this biennium, and I don't believe you can do that within current revenue projections without making cuts such as this. So I truly believe it is.
What your interpretation is not the one that I got from my community.
I understand. I would argue that you can still provide monies to art programs throughout the state. You might have artists come into the classroom and provide some technical expertise. But truly, I believe this is a choice between school teachers and artists. I really do. Because that's where the money goes now.
Okay. Nicole?
Okay. Chair Kremel and
committee members. My name is Nicole Brigato, and I'm testifying in support of House Bill 3319. What the bill does is instead of the 1% for art going toward the purchase of art to decorate the public buildings, the 1% for art would instead go to the Department of Education to be distributed among the school districts for the purposes of funding art education. And that would include paying teachers, training teachers, buying art supplies, and also paying for programs such as taking the kids to field trips or bringing in guest speakers or helpers or artists from the community to teach the students. And I don't know if I'm repeating what Randy says, but I just think I came up with this as we were trying to think of different ways outside of the box to get money into our schools. And it just doesn't seem that no matter how much we budget or that the legislature budgets for the schools, that they always are looking for more money and need to have more money. And the thought behind this is that if they can have the money into these specifically allocated for art programs, which are generally one of the first things to be cut besides music and sports programs, that they would continue to have the benefit of having art programs in schools. And that the schools then could use the money that they're normally budgeted to buy things like textbooks and to pay their other teachers and whatnot.
Okay. Are there any questions for either person? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have Christine D'Arcy and Linda Worrell Poole. Did I say that right? Come up, please.
Representative Crummell and members of the committee, my name is Christine D'Arcy. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Arts Commission. In my spare time, I am the mother of two children in public schools here in Salem. The Oregon Arts Commission has strong reservations about House Bill 3319 and does not support the bill moving forward. House Bill 3319 proposes to eliminate the state requirement that 1% of the construction costs of state buildings be set aside for artwork for those buildings, and instead proposes to use the percent for art allocation to establish a new fund for arts education within the Oregon Department of Education. The Arts Commission places a very high value on arts education for all Oregon students. We provide annual grant support to a network of arts education providers, such as the Lane Arts Council, such as the Lynn Benton Council on the Arts, who operate regional arts education programs on behalf of the Arts Commission. We have just entered into a three-year partnership with the Ford Family Foundation to fund artist residencies in rural schools, and that is an example of really the new way that we are looking for new money to support this work. We require that each one of our operating support grantees offers arts education as part of their ongoing programs. Oregon students deserve more arts experiences in schools, but the Percent for Art program is not the appropriate funding vehicle. Oregon's 1% program is really a public works program. Public artwork, often integrated with architecture, very often integrated with architecture on the campuses of Oregon State and the University of Oregon, enhances our public spaces. Our public art program is nationally recognized and was one of the first to be adopted. It really makes the difference between a space and a place. I mean, imagine the Capitol here without the murals and the rotunda and the gold man on the top. Percent for art funds create jobs. The dollars flow directly back into the local economy. Artists are commissioned as contractors. They hire local companies, they hire subs, they pour concrete, they rent trucks, they hire cranes. In a typical outdoor commission, probably about 80% of the funding goes straight back into the local economy. The loss of Oregon's Percent for Art program would truly be a loss for the arts in Oregon. We encourage you to not move the bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Linda Worrell Poole, and I am speaking as an artist, as a gallery owner, and as a retired art teacher in the state of Oregon. I very much support everything that Chris just said, but I would like to add a few other points. Having been an art teacher for 30 years in Oregon, I started teaching before we had a 1% for the arts. I retired from teaching in 1999 after 30 years of teaching. And at that point, it was very nice to be able to tell my students about a piece of architecture, a piece of artwork that had to do with that architecture, and ask that they please go and try to view that, experience it, be a part of it. Without the 1% for the arts, that cannot happen. One of the things that I see as an important part of the 1% for the arts is that it is a record of the artwork that is being done in this state for that period of time. If it is voted on every biennium, we will have a two-year period of time where no public art is recorded in those buildings that has to do with that architecture. As an artist, I receive all of the information, brochures on the new buildings being built, and it's very exciting for me to look at those and see the places where this art is intended, and my imagination can just go wild and I can think about the possibilities of what's going to be produced for that. So as an artist, I also very much appreciate the opportunity to be given that format for my imagination and for the hopes of what is going to be put there eventually. I think that it would be a very sad state of affairs if the 1% of the arts was discontinued, even for one biennium. I don't think it's such a huge amount of money that it's going to make a huge difference in art education in the schools. Having been a teacher, as I said, I think right now in our state it's very, very important to have the format to go and experience and visit. You can teach all you want in the classroom, but if there's nothing to support it on the outside in examples, it becomes the teacher's opinion rather than a place for assurance or security.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any questions for either of these ladies? Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Is there anyone else that wanted to speak on House Bill 3319? Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3319. And members, you can go ahead and go to the floor if you would like to. I'm going to just tap in a couple of other bills here. And the work sessions that we had scheduled for today will just be held over to Tuesday. And one other thing, and we'll catch up with our other members. Please be thinking about we may need to have an evening meeting next week. Be thinking about, and I don't know if Tuesday will work.
We don't know. I think we're finished.
And so,
Judish, I think we're out.
Are we? Okay. So it might it could potentially be Tuesday evening. So anyway, I just bring that up, and I'll let you know via written communication as soon as a determination is made. And it'll be by tomorrow afternoon.
So you don't need us to stay here then?
No, I don't need you to stay here. I'm going to just open and close public hearings.
Mr. Chair, maybe on setting that date, maybe we can do a canvassing just to see
sure.
What might work better.
You bet. Absolutely. Thank you. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3496, close public hearing on House Bill 3496, open a public hearing on 2961, close public hearing on 2961, open a public hearing on 2857, close public hearing on 2857, open a public hearing on House Bill 3612, close public hearing on House Bill 3612. With that, we have finished our business for today. We stand adjourned.
Carrie, Tuesday.